start out by asking you guys a question, and it is a deep question, but have you ever had a moment where you felt like everything in your life was falling apart? I know I have. My hand's the first one being raised. Maybe it's a health scare or a diagnosis that just came out of nowhere. Maybe you recently lost a loved one and you're hurting, you feel lonely. Maybe you're here today and you're caring for an aging parent. And there are days where you just feel just emotionally and physically and spiritually just drained. Maybe you're praying for the addiction that your spouse has here today. Or maybe that you're praying that they would finally give their life to the Lord. Maybe you're a parent here in the room and your heart has just been crushed because your child has been making some unwise decisions. Or you know that they're even troubling and having problems of even believing in the existence of God himself. Maybe you're here today and you're praying for breakthrough in your marriage, your family, your finances, your future, your career, and nothing seems to be happening. Like you've prayed, you've trusted, and you've waited. And if you're honest, there have been moments where you've looked up and you've wondered, God, where are you in all of this? And sometimes it's not just what's happening in our own lives because it's happening everywhere around us. It seems like every time I turn on the news, it feels like darkness is spreading. Evil and demonic activity are being celebrated. Christians and God, man, they're just being mocked and humiliated. People are walking away from the faith. And it's in moments like that where we're tempted to ask, God, are you even still there? Are you in control? Because one of the hardest things about following Jesus is that sometimes God's plan doesn't look like God's plan. Sometimes it looks like chaos. Sometimes it looks like loss. Sometimes it looks like darkness is winning. Because when we're in the middle of a story, which we are all in, we often can't see what God is doing behind the scenes. And that's exactly where we find ourselves here in John chapter 18. Now, Pastor Mark last week shared with us that Jesus prayed this prayer and he said, Father, the hour has come. The hour of his betrayal, the hour of his suffering, the hour of his death. And now in chapter 18, that hour has finally arrived. Now remember, John wrote, he tells us that he wrote the Gospel of John so that he could tell us one thing, that Jesus truly is the Messiah, the Son of God. And so everything that John records is meant to answer this one question, who is Jesus? So as we move into the darkest moments of Jesus's life, John wants us to see something very clearly. Jesus is not a victim here. He is not being trapped. He is not being manipulated. He is not being surprised, and he is not losing control. In fact, John goes out of his way to show us that Jesus is actually orchestrating everything that is about to happen. So here in chapter 18, we actually see two plans colliding. There's Satan's plot to kill Jesus, and then there's God's plan to kill Jesus. Both are in the intent of killing Jesus, but for two completely different reasons. Satan's plot is for evil to reign, but God's plan is to pour out his wrath towards sin on his one and only sinless son. Now, let me set the stage for you. John 18 begins with Jesus and his disciples, and they're leaving the upper room, and they're heading to the Garden of Gethsemane. And as soon as they step out of that room, man, it's like the first domino starts to fall. Everything that has been building out through the book of John is now beginning to move rapidly towards its conclusion. It's like one step leading to the other. The garden, the betrayal, the rest, the trials, the cross, the tomb, and the resurrection. Everything changes the moment that Jesus walks out of that room. And here's the tension that we see and that we have all felt at one point or the other, and it is this question. What do you do when it looks like darkness is winning? What do you do? Because if it were you standing there in the garden and you saw Judas coming down the hillside with all those Roman soldiers and temple guards, and you see Jesus the Messiah get arrested, you would have thought to yourself, everything is falling apart. It would have looked like that evil had finally won, that God has somehow or another been outwitted and he is ultimately lost. But John wants us to see what the disciples couldn't see in that moment, and it is this. Even when everything looked out of control, Jesus was completely in control. Let's set the stage. John 18, verse 1, let's dive in. After saying these things, Jesus crossed the Kidron Valley with his disciples, and he entered a grove of olive trees. Judas, the betrayer, he knew this place because Jesus had often gone there with his disciples. The leading priests and the Pharisees, they had given Judas a contingent of Roman soldiers and temple guards to accompany him. Now with blazing torches, lanterns, and weapons, they arrived at the olive grove. Now, before we go any further, I want you to notice something interesting about John's gospel. John had just spent the previous 5 chapters in the upper room. 5 chapters, 1 room. 1 final evening with Jesus and his disciples. And then all of a sudden, they're in the garden. Now, what's interesting is that John, he actually omits some of the details that the other gospels write about. He doesn't mention the Lord's Prayer. He doesn't even mention the Garden of Gethsemane by name. And he doesn't even go into the lengths to describe Jesus' agonizing prayer in the garden where he just cried out to God, being like, God, if there's any other way, take this cup from me, the cup of suffering, the cup of death. He's saying, let it pass. Instead, John takes us straight to the arrest. Now, why does he do that? Because John wants us to see very clearly that Jesus is not a victim. Now notice what the text says. It says Jesus enters the garden, not because he doesn't know what's coming, but because he does know what's coming. You see, the garden to him, it wasn't a hiding place. In fact, it was a very familiar place. Because in verse 2, Judas said that he already knew where to find Jesus. Why? Because Jesus had often met the disciples there with him. I want you to think about that for a moment. Jesus walked right into the very same place where he knew that he would be betrayed. Jesus knew that Judas would find him there. He knew that he would be betrayed. This is Jesus' resolve to go to the very same spot where he knew he would be betrayed. Jesus is moving towards his betrayal resolutely. He is moving towards his arrest. He is moving towards his death. He is undaunted. He is unhesitating. He is not being manipulated. He is not being tricked. He's not being trapped by men's plans. No, he's not surprised by anything. And if you recall, Jesus said this in John chapter 10. He said, no one takes my life from me. I lay it down on my own accord. I lay it down. So as Jesus enters the garden, here comes Judas with what? It says a contingent of Roman soldiers and temple guards. Y'all, this is not a group of bullies coming to get Jesus. They're not just sneaking into the garden. Judas is coming into the garden with Roman soldiers and temple guards. Now, some scholars actually believe that this could have consisted of hundreds of armed men coming to arrest Jesus. That's a massive show of force. Now, picture this scene with me. Jesus and his disciples, they would have seen these men coming from a distance. They would have heard them coming, the clanging of the armor, the rattling of the weapons, the flickering flames of the torches through the night. And Jesus and his disciples, they're hearing and they're watching all of this commotion come down from the Kidron Valley into the garden. And this is an amazing. It is filled with the full force of armed men coming to arrest a Galilean carpenter. Now, here's the thing about Judas. Judas not only misunderstood the nature of Jesus, actually thinking that Jesus would actually fight back in that moment, but he also misunderstood, or shall I say, misestimated the power of Jesus. Judas thought that he needed soldiers. Judas thought that he needed weapons. He thought he needed an overwhelming force. Well, I got news for you. If Jesus wanted to fight, how many soldiers would be enough? You couldn't have enough. Judas didn't understand who Jesus was, and he certainly didn't understand the power that Jesus possessed. The collision of the two plans that I talked about is at hand. You know, as I was studying this week, I couldn't help but notice that this isn't the first garden story in the Bible. Where does the Bible open up? It begins in the Garden of Eden. This is where Adam, he meets the serpent. This is when he gives into temptation. This is when sin enters the world and everything from that point has been falling apart. And now we find ourselves in another garden, but this time it's not Adam standing there, it is Jesus. Where Adam once failed, Jesus won't. The first Adam, he brought sin into the world, but Jesus, man, he's about to go to the cross and he's about to save the world. What was once lost in one garden is about to be restored in another. The gospel's fascinating, y'all. The gospel is beautiful. Let's continue in verse 4. Jesus fully realized all that was going to happen to him. So he stepped forward to meet them. "Who are you looking for?" he asked. "Jesus the Nazarene," they replied. "I am," Jesus said. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. And as Jesus said, "I am," they all drew back and fell to the ground. Can you just picture this for a moment? I mean, Judas has arrived. The soldiers are there. The torches are burning. The weapons are drawn. And the garden is filled with all these forced men. And Jesus is just standing there watching it all unfold. And then in verse 4, Jesus actually does something remarkable. It says that he stepped forward. Can you imagine their surprise? I bet they were just thinking to themselves that they're going to come into this olive grove trying to find a Galilean peasant probably just hiding amongst the trees and the bushes. But no, Jesus took the lead just like a good shepherd would. He didn't back away. He didn't run. Rather, he stepped forward. It's as if he's saying, "Here I am, guys. I'm not running. I'm not hiding. I'm ready for this. I'm ready for this." I want you to notice where Jesus is in this particular passage. When he says, "Who are you looking for?" I don't think Jesus was looking for information. He knew why they were there. He knew that they were coming to arrest him, right? He knew that. So why ask the question? I want you to notice where Jesus is in this situation. The disciples are behind him. The soldiers are in front of him. And what does Jesus do? He steps forward, just like a good shepherd would. It's almost like he's saying, "Hey, before anybody does anything, let's be real clear about who you come for." You see, Jesus, he's not trying to protect himself here. He's protecting his disciples. Think about what Pastor Mark shared last week in John 17, that Jesus prayed this prayer. He says, "Protect them by the power of your name." And then he said later, "While I was with them, I protected and I guarded them." And that is exactly what Jesus is still doing. Even in the midst of his arrest, Jesus is protecting his disciples. So Jesus asked, he says, "Who are you looking for?" And they answered, "Jesus the Nazarene." Now I want you to pay very close attention to Jesus' response, because he says, "I am." Now some translations say, "I am he," but oftentimes that word "he" is in italics because a translator actually added it so that it would actually read smoothly in English. But Jesus is literally saying, "I am," meaning ego eimi. This is the exact same phrase that God used to reveal his name to Moses in the book of Exodus. Now, by this point in John's gospel, through our study as a church together, that phrase, "I am," should sound familiar, right? Because Jesus has over and over again, he has said that he is an "I am." He's mentioned these "I am" statements to reveal who he is. But here in the garden at night with the soldiers in front of him, Jesus simply doesn't identify himself, but rather he declares and reveals himself. He's expressing his deity here. He spoke to them as he were God. And then did you notice what happened next? Look at verse 6 very carefully. When Jesus said, "I am," they drew back and fell to the ground. Woo! Let that movie play out in your mind just like it did mine. The torches, the lanterns, the weapons, the soldiers, Judas standing among them. Jesus steps forward. "Who are you looking for?" "Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus replies, "I am." And suddenly this armed group of soldiers, they fall back on the ground, Judas included. They buckle at the power of Jesus' voice. Absolutely incredible. One moment they're marching into the garden full of confidence, and then the next morning they're on their backsides in the dirt. Why? Because just for a brief moment, Jesus has given them a glimpse, a tiny glimpse of who they're actually dealing with. It actually reminds me of Psalm 29, where it says, "The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic." Listen, this is the same voice that spoke creation into existence. This is the same voice that calmed the storms. This is the same voice that raised Lazarus from the dead. And now with two words, that voice brings an entire army to the ground like dominoes. I don't think this was by accident. I don't think that the soldiers just like stumbled over one another. No, I think there was definitely something miraculous about here. This actually was a momentary, powerful display of the power and the presence of God. It was almost as if Jesus was reminding everyone in the garden there, don't mistake my surrender for weakness, because I am going willingly. Because if his voice can bring soldiers to the ground, I mean, he could have stopped the arrest altogether, right? Jesus wasn't overpowered here. He surrendered himself willingly. Doesn't this show that Jesus was in complete control of the situation? I mean, think about it. The moment that says Jesus says, I am, they hit the ground. I mean, if Jesus really wanted to escape, he could have kept on saying, I am, I am, I am, and they just would have stayed on the ground and he could have gotten out of Dodge. Right? But he didn't. Why? Why didn't he do it? Because he's not trying to avoid the cross. You with me? He is moving towards it. Let's get something straight. The soldiers, they're not taking Jesus. Jesus is giving himself. Here's the second thing I want you to see here. This is an incredible display of the glory of God. I want you to think about this contrast, because in just a few short moments, Jesus is about to allow these men to bind his hands and take him away. This is the Son of God willingly submitting himself to an arrest. You want to know what that is? That's humility. But before he does, he says two words, I am, and that reveals his majestic splendor and power, and they all fall down to the ground. You know what that is? That's glory, my friends. Jesus is actually showing us something here. We got to pay close attention. Jesus is showing us something here about the way that God oftentimes works. You see, many times God will display his power and the glory through the middle of what looks like weakness. In the middle of what looks like humility, in the middle of what looks like surrender. And you actually see this pattern all throughout the life of Jesus. He was born as a baby, but he was announced by angels. He was laid in a manger, but he was signaled by a star. He submitted himself to baptism as if he were a sinner, yet moments later he received a voice of approval from the Father. When he got tired, he slept in a boat. Then moments later he gets up and he calms the raging storm. He wept over the loss of a friend, but then he raised that friend back to life. And then he surrenders himself to arrest, but then spoke two words, an entire army falls to the ground. He died on a cross with no fault, but through that death, he defeated sin, Satan, and the grave. That right there, oftentimes, is how God works. God often displays his glory in the midst of humility, his power in the middle of weakness. I don't want you to miss the encouragement that is over your life. Because sometimes God allows us to go through seasons that feel weak. He allows us to go through seasons that feel humbling to us. Seasons that don't look victorious to us. But don't ever be afraid when God allows you to go through the seasons of feeling weak and humbling or even hopeless. Why? Because he just might be setting the stage for a beautiful display of glory in your life. Now, here's a question that I've been wrestling with all week. Why? Why knock them down? Why reveal his power like that if he's just gonna let him rest them anyway? I want you to hold on to that thought, because what happens next is gonna answer that question. Let's continue in verse 7. Once more, he asked them, who are you looking for? And again, they replied, Jesus the Nazarene. I told you that I am. Now, I just imagine themselves like bracing themselves at this moment, a little bit of fearful, right? And since I am the one you want, let these others go. He did this to fulfill his own statement. I did not lose a single one of those that you have given me. So Jesus asked them again, who are you looking for? And here we start to see the answer to our question. Why did Jesus knock them down? Why reveal his power? It certainly wasn't on his own behalf. I mean, Jesus was going to surrender. Listen to me. He knocked them down to let them know that if you don't let these other go, I'm going to keep knocking you down all day long. What was on Jesus' mind at that moment? It wasn't protecting himself. It was protecting his disciples. So as the soldiers, as they got back up on their feet again, Jesus says, hey, let's come back to this. Who are you looking for? You looking for Jesus of Nazareth? I'm your guy. You want me? You got me. But let these go. That right there is the heart of a shepherd. A shepherd puts himself in front of harm's way so that the sheep don't have to. And that's exactly what Jesus did. He said, take me, not them, not them. Now, what's amazing is that every one of these disciples, with the exception of John, they would go on and later suffer and die for their faith in Jesus. Jesus knew that, but he also knew that they would need to be filled with the power of the Holy Spirit to embolden them to go with confidence to spread the good news of Jesus, the message of Jesus and forgiveness and salvation. But he knew that they would face persecution and suffering because of their faith in Jesus. He knew that. He knew that Peter would one day be crucified. He knew that James would one day be executed. He knew all the trials that the disciples would eventually face, but they weren't ready for that yet. And Jesus knew it. So he says, let these go. Can I encourage you with something? Jesus knows what you're ready for. He knows what you're ready for now, and he knows what you're not ready for yet. In fact, he knows you a lot more than you think you know yourself. It's not that Jesus was trying to spare these disciples from all the hardships. No, he wasn't. He knew the hardship was coming. He knew the sacrifice and the suffering was coming. Just not yet. Jesus knew exactly what the disciples needed in that moment. He knew the season that they were in. He knew what they were carrying. And he knew what he was preparing them for. And he would not allow them to be tested beyond what they were ready for at that time. So he says, let them go. And here's the good news. Jesus still works that way today. He still works that way today. I mean, have you ever looked back on a season in your life, man, and said, man, if that would have happened to me 5 years ago, that would have crushed me. Anyone been there? But now, God has matured you, strengthened you, protected you. What changed? God was preparing you. Sometimes the very things that we're asking God to remove in our life are the things that he's preparing us to face. Not alone, not in our strength, but with his strength, his presence, and by his Spirit. Because God knows exactly what you need and exactly what he's preparing you for. God knows exactly what you need and exactly what he's preparing you for. So as the disciples leave and Jesus stays, for the first time in this story, Jesus stands alone. And now Peter is about to do what Peter always does. Let's check it out, verse 10. Then Simon Peter, he drew a sword and he slashed off the right ear of Malchus, the high priest slave. But Jesus said to Peter, put your sword back in its sheath. Shall I not drink from the cup of suffering that the Father has given me? So the soldiers, the commanding officers, and the temple guards, they arrested Jesus and tied him up. Isn't this just like Peter? I mean, Jesus has everything under control. The soldiers are on the ground. Jesus is protecting his disciples. Jesus is orchestrating this entire situation, and Peter still thinks that he's gotta do something about this situation. So what does he do? He grabs a sword. And honestly, before we get too hard on Peter, aren't we a lot like Peter too? When things don't go according to plan, what do? We take matters into our own hands. We try to fix things. We try to control things. We try to force an outcome that we want, because that's what Peter's doing. Peter sees an arrest. He sees an ambush. He sees his teacher, his Messiah, his friend getting arrested. All of his worst fears are coming true. And what he sees in front of himself is everything unraveling. But Peter cannot see what Jesus sees. Peter couldn't see what God was accomplishing in the moment. He only saw what God was allowing. So he grabbed a sword. It's like when you're teaching a child to ride a bike, right? There comes a moment where you gotta learn to let go, right? Now the child's not gonna want you to let go because they're afraid. They want you to hold on. But if you don't let go, that child's never gonna learn how to ride on its own. Sometimes what feels unsafe to us is actually part of the process. Peter couldn't see that. So he grabbed a sword. How often do we do the same thing? God says, wait, yet we grab a sword. God says, trust me, yet we grab a sword. God says, I've got this, yet we grab a sword. I don't know what your sword is here today, but maybe your sword is trying to fix your spouse. Maybe your sword is trying to control your kid or even your adult children. Maybe your sword is trying to force open a door that God hasn't even opened up yet. Maybe your sword is losing sleep over a situation because you've convinced yourself that you're the only one that can figure it out. Maybe your sword is carrying a burden that God never asked you to carry to begin with. I think someone needs to hear this today. Put your sword away. Put your sword away. Peter represents every single one of us. He's trying to fix what only Jesus can fix with the cross. And then Jesus says in verse 11, he says, put your sword back into its sheath. No, Peter, I'm not praising you for this heroic act. Put your sword away because I have to drink the cup that the Father has given me. The cup wasn't interrupting God's plan. The cup was God's plan. And Jesus, when he looked at that cup that was before him, he didn't want it. Remember, he pleaded with God the Father. He said, Lord, if there's any other way, let this cup pass before me. Because he knew what was in the cup. He knew that there was betrayal in the cup. He knew that there was rejection in the cup. He knew that was suffering in the cup. He knew that there was persecution in the cup. He knew that there was separation from God in the cup. He knew there was a brutal execution in the cup. He knew that the wrath of God towards sin was in the cup. My sin, your sin, all of everyone's sin. He knew what was in the cup. And I guarantee you, if I were to pass around this cup here today, and I would say, hey, you're gonna drink it, but I tell you what's in this cup is every ounce of betrayal and rejection and persecution that you have faced, every consequence of sin, I guarantee you none of you would drink it. Neither would I. But Jesus did, knowingly, willingly, lovingly, because he knew what was in the cup. But he also knew what was on the other side of the cup. There was redemption in the cup. There was a restored relationship with our Heavenly Father in the cup. Forgiveness was in the cup. Salvation was in the cup. Your freedom was in the cup. So Peter, he looked at Jesus and he says, put your sword away. Peter, stop trying to fight what God is doing here. Stop trying to rescue me. Don't you see? I'm rescuing you. That right there is the heart and the message of John 18. The disciples, they looked at the garden and they thought everything is falling apart. Jesus is being arrested. Darkness has won. This is over. But Jesus, he looked at that very same garden. He said, everything is going according to plan. Judas isn't in control. The Roman soldiers aren't in control. The religious leaders aren't in control. Satan's not in control, but Jesus was. Church, the problem wasn't the fact that the disciples got their facts wrong. No, they didn't. They were right about their facts. They just could not see the whole story. And maybe that's where some of us find ourselves today. Maybe you're standing in your own garden right now, not a place of peace, but a place of tension. Maybe it's a place of waiting or uncertainty. Maybe it's a place of where you're just saying, God, where are you? What are you doing? Are you even in control? And just like the disciples, all you can see in front of you are soldiers, your problems, your situations, your circumstances. But what you can't see is what God is doing behind the scenes or how he's going to use it or what he's preparing for on the other side of it. I want to leave you with this. Just because you can't see what God is doing, it does not mean that God isn't working. What if the thing that you're calling chaos in life, God is going to use it for purpose? What if the thing that you're calling lost in your life, God is going to use it for redemption? What if the thing that you feels out of control is actually resting into the hands of a Savior who has never lost control for a single moment? Because John 18 reminds us of this. Even when everything looked out of control, Jesus was completely in control. Would everyone stand with me? Everyone stand with me. Before we talk about what our response should be to this passage, can we all just take a moment and just go and worship the name of Jesus? Because we gotta stop lifting, we gotta lift up our eyes off of the problems, off of the darkness that we're surrounding ourselves in, and we gotta put our eyes and our focus and attention on the name of Jesus and exalt Jesus. Come on, let's do that. Let's go into worship.